Tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to listen to Jesus. But the Pharisees and scribes began to complain, saying, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So to them Jesus addressed this parable. A man had two sons, and the younger son said to his father, "Father, give me the share of your estate that should come to me." So the father divided the property between them. After a few days, the younger son collected all his belongings and set off to a distant country, where he squandered his inheritance on a life of dissipation. When he had freely spent everything, a severe famine struck that country, and he found himself in dire need. So he hired himself out to one of the local citizens, who sent him to his farm to tend the swine. And he longed to eat his fill of the pods on which the swine fed, but nobody gave him any. Coming to his senses, he thought, "How many of my father's hired workers have more than enough food to eat, but here am I, dying from hunger. I shall get up and go to my father and I shall say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me as you would treat one of your hired workers.' So he got up and went back to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father caught sight of him and was filled with compassion. He ran to his son, embraced him, and kissed him. His son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son.' But his father ordered his servants, 'Quickly bring the finest robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Take the fattened calf and slaughter it. Then let us celebrate with a feast, because this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found.' Then the celebration began. Now the older son had been out in the field, and on his way back, as he neared the house, he heard the sound of music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked what this might mean. The servant said to him, 'Your brother has returned, and your father has slaughtered the fattened calf, because he has him back safe and sound.' He became angry, and when he refused to enter the house, the father came out and pleaded with him. He said to his father in reply, 'Look, all these years I served you, and not once did I disobey your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat to feast on with my friends. But when your son returns, who swallowed up your property with prostitutes, for him you slaughtered the fattened calf.' He said to him, 'My son, you are here with me always. Everything I have is yours. But now we must celebrate and rejoice, because your brother was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found.'" The Gospel of the Lord. I preached this morning at the 7:30 Mass, but just now, sitting over there, I got a new idea for a homily, and I want to preach it. So if things look a little bit messy and unprepared, forgive me. So I had a professor in seminary who, we had these priests, there's maybe 8 or 10 priests that lived at the seminary, and some of them we couldn't go to confession to because they were directly responsible for our formation. But then, of the ones that were available, we usually, picked the one that was the easiest confessor, which is not that different probably than something you might do. And there was a priest I went to often, because he's a gentle confessor, and he always said to me, when I was done with my confession, he said, "Clearly Jesus preferred the company of sinners." And that really stuck with me, and it stuck with me over the years. And, first of all, kind of asking the question, is that true? Does Jesus prefer the company of sinners? And what does it mean? And this parable of the prodigal son that we hear today, it's one of those scriptures that we know so well. We know so well that it's kind of inscribed in our minds and hearts, and we can often lose the context. Like, the story stands alone in our memory, and we lose the context within which the story is set in the gospel. So look at the first couple of lines of this gospel. Tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to listen to Jesus, But the Pharisees and scribes began to complain, saying, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, the reason Jesus tells this parable is because this is something that comes up several times in the gospel, is that Jesus is sort of surrounded by sinners, and he fellowships with them. He doesn't, condemn them. He doesn't look down on them. He doesn't send them away. He doesn't scoff at them. But these are people that, polite society would scorn, right? They're on the fringe. They're outcasts. They're sinners. They're unrighteous people. And a righteous, respectable person would turn their back on him, right? This is not somebody you want to be seen associating with in public. And yet Jesus is dining with these people. And we hear several times in the gospel that people are scandalized by that. They're scandalized by the company Jesus keeps. And it's in response to that scandal that he tells the story of the prodigal son. And remembering what that priest in seminary said, that Jesus clearly preferred the company of sinners, I propose an answer why. It's because sinners, which we should clarify, is all of us. It's interesting in the gospel when Jesus says, "I've not come for the righteous, but for sinners." There's an irony in that because none of us are in ourselves righteous. We're all sinners. So the only way to distinguish between those two people is not to say that some of these are sinners and need Jesus and some are righteous and don't, but some of them know they're sinners and are open to Jesus. And some are righteous and they're not. So the greatest of all of the deadly sins, the deadliest of all the deadly sins is pride. Right, it's pride that the saying goes, pride goeth before the fall. And when our first parents sinned, they ate, the first sin was disobedience, right? Eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But it was motivated by pride. And it was pride that led, it was through pride that Satan tempted Adam and Eve. And he said, if you eat this, you'll be like God. You won't be dependent upon him. You won't have to have him tell you what's right and wrong or what's true and what's not true. You can be like gods yourselves. So it was pride. It was the desire to not be submissive, not be obedient, not be dependent, but to reach out and become self-sustaining. Pride is the most dangerous of all the deadly sins. And there's a particularly virulent form of pride called spiritual pride. Spiritual pride essentially tempts us to believe that we can earn the Father's love, that we can merit our salvation simply by being righteous and doing righteous deeds. And spiritual pride, the reason it's so virulent, the reason it's so dangerous, is because those of us that are hampered by spiritual pride, we feel like we're righteous. We feel like we're already in the Father's house. We're in right relationship with the Father. We're on the right track, right? We feel like we deserve heaven. And so we can, in a sense, turn our back on God in a way that the tax collectors and the prostitutes maybe are not tempted to do. Because if you know that you've spent your life in abject sin, one thing you're not tempted to think is that you can rely on yourself. And those of us who are guilty of really big sins, we are much less tempted to believe that we deserve the Father's love or that we merit salvation. So I look at the story of the two sons and notice something about the end, the second son, right? The one who's upset that the father is rejoicing over his younger brother. You see what the scriptures tell us, he became angry and he refused to enter the house. He refused to enter the house. Now, I think in this parable, and this is where I'm coming off the cuff, so stay with me. But in this parable, the house, the Father's house, really is an image for heaven, right? It's an image for being with our Father for eternity in heaven. And both of the sons, at least in part of the parable, leave the house. They do it for different reasons. But what's interesting about the second son is he won't come in the house out of a sense of stubbornness, and it's really spiritual pride that won't allow him to come in, right? The first son, he has lived this kind of wicked life, and he really, really offends his father. He says, "Give me my share of your inheritance," right, which is what I'll get when you die. "Give it to me now, And I'm going to take it and I'm going to go squander it in a foreign land on loose living. Right? But then he really has the ability to humble himself and come crawling back to the Father. And as a result, he receives the Father's love. He receives actually a great outpouring of the Father's love and mercy. And the Father doesn't turn him away, and he doesn't even treat him like one of his hired servants like he planned on asking for. He puts the ring on his finger and the robe on him and gives him sandals, slaughters the fattened calf, right? And draws him back into the house. And he's going to be his beloved son just as much as he ever was. And now we have the older brother, the responsible one, the faithful one, the one who didn't, you know, take his father's inheritance and go on a spree to Las Vegas, right? The one who, for the most part, has stayed on the straight and narrow. But a much, maybe more dangerous temptation besets him, right? It's the temptation to say, I deserve this. The party that my younger brother is having thrown in his honor, I deserve it. I've earned that party. My place in the Father's house, my inheritance, I deserve it. I earned it because I'm righteous. And so here we have, I really wish the gospel, I really wish the parable was finished, but Jesus leaves it unfinished, right? I really want to know, does the son go back into the house? Because in a sense, it seems that the possibility stands here before us of this son who was basically faithful, who didn't live a life of great sin, didn't squander his inheritance, didn't live in dissipation, but at least when the parable leaves off, he's standing outside the Father's house because his pride won't let him in. Right? At this point, he's having trouble accepting that the Father's love is not something that he can earn. There's nothing we can do to lose the Father's love, and there's nothing we can do to earn it. So there's a book by C.S. Lewis. I don't know if you've read it. It's called The Great Divorce. He's not Catholic, but he's almost Catholic. And I even read this book in one of my classes this year. And The Great Divorce is sort of this, he sets up this image, it's kind of like a parable in its own right, of these people who are seemingly in the antechamber of heaven. And C.S. Lewis, I think, famously said that the doors of hell are locked from the inside. And the Orthodox part of me, the teacher part of me that likes accuracy, gets nervous when people talk like that, right? That the doors of hell are locked from the inside. That the only people that go to hell are those who choose it, right? And I get nervous because there's a right way and a wrong way to understand that. The wrong way to understand that would be what we call fundamental option theory, which is that it doesn't really matter what I do as long as in my heart of hearts I really want to be with God, right? That's a wrong understanding of the moral life. But a right understanding of it is this, that the choices we make throughout our lives, we're in a sense choosing what we want. And when we leave time and enter an eternity, in a sense, that finalizes the choice. So we have, for instance, in The Great Divorce, we have this scene where a man sees a murderer that he knew in life, and he's on the path, and he's walking into heaven, and he's outraged. Because this man was wicked. This man was a murderer. And if he's going in there, it's not a place that I want to be. And it's a very strong image because the man essentially turns away, gets back on the bus, and doesn't go into the heavenly kingdom because he's too proud to be somewhere that this murderer can go. Right? That he lived his whole life being righteous, and now somebody's basically getting in on charity, and he couldn't stand that. It really reminds me of this image of the second son standing outside the father's house, refusing to go in because his unfaithful younger brother had been received so mercifully. And so, brothers and sisters, we want to be on, we know that pride is a sin. We want to be especially on guard against this spiritual pride, against this sense that I don't need to rely on the Father's love or on the Father's mercy, right? That pride that doesn't allow me to be like a little child, simply receiving something that, frankly, I don't deserve. Right? We want to have the spiritual humility to know that we don't deserve it, right? We can do nothing to lose the Father's love, but we can do nothing to gain the Father's love or earn it either. But if we can become like children, if we can have the humility of the first son, even when we're unfaithful, even when we're wicked, we can repent and we can return to him and we can receive a new an even greater outpouring of the love and the mercy of our merciful Father, and there will be great rejoicing in heaven.